Well, one doesn't want to rely on any one person for any source of information. This is an interview with Professor Joe B. Wilson, who is retired, was a professor of bacteriology and of medical microbiology, and chairman of both of those departments, was also an associate dean of the graduate school. The date is December 7th, 1983. I'm Laura Smale, and we're interviewing in the Medical Science Building in the Medical Microbiology Department. I will ask you to begin with to tell me something about your background, your parents, what got you interested in science, your education.
I was born in Dallas, Texas, and grew up there. My father was a merchant, but my grandfather had been a physician who came to Dallas in 1885 from North Carolina, and he was the first city health officer of Dallas. But because of his death, my father was in medical school but had to drop out and support the family, as one would have to at the turn of the century. So he became a merchant, and that's the atmosphere in which I grew up. But I went to the University of Texas as an undergraduate and took a course in bacteriology from a man who was an excellent teacher, Dr. I.M. Lewis, and he interested me in bacteriology as he had so many other people. And how I got to Wisconsin...
Before you come to Wisconsin, had you become interested in science before you went to college? Did you major in it at college?
Yes, in college, yes. I majored. I actually had a joint major in chemistry and in bacteriology by the time I finished. Mm-hmm. It took me about 5.5 years to get a bachelor's degree. Was I was out of school for a year and a half during that time. I had a lot of eye problem, and so was out of the university. Mm-hmm. And then and worked in my father's store, and I knew that I didn't want to do that. Mm-hmm. And so it was a real relief to decide to go back to the university, and with what I knew about, and I've been doing reading in the time I was working. Mm-hmm. And I had become interested in science before I had this year and a half layout. And so when I went back, I knew I wanted to major in bacteriology, and I knew also by that time that it required a lot of chemistry, so I took a joint major between chemistry and bacteriology at the University of Texas. And I got a bachelor's degree in 1939.
And why did you come to the University of Wisconsin?
Well, Dr. Lewis, as I said, was an excellent teacher, and he picked some of the young people coming through that department. It was a department of botany and bacteriology at Austin. He picked young people to be what we would call now teaching assistants. Some of them, and I started in my junior year as a teaching assistant, helping, particularly preparing culture media and things like that. And then finally, in my senior year, I was Dr. Lewis's assistant in teaching his course in bacterial cytology. Dr. Lewis was a good friend of E.B. Fred here at the University of Wisconsin. And starting back in the early 1930s, Dr. Fred accepted about one student a year that Dr. Lewis would recommend come to Wisconsin. And so there is a good long list of people who, in the 1930s anyway, got their undergraduate training at Austin and then came to Madison and got their graduate training in the Department of Bacteriology or the Department of Medical Microbiology, either one of them. So that's how I got to Madison. I came here in 1939. I had on Wisconsin Lung Research Foundation money and was a research assistant with Perry Wilson over in the Department of Bacteriology. I took a master's degree, and then in 1942 went off to the Army, and I just about finished my PhD. But when I came back in 1946 as an instructor in the Department of Bacteriology and finished my PhD after I got back.
Bob Burris was also a graduate student of Perry Wilson's.
Yes,
wasn't
Bob.
He
was, and Bob and I worked in the laboratory together.
He said that Perry Wilson's lab was better equipped than other labs, and that he had more money.
Perry did have more money. Perry had a grant from the Frisch Foundation for work in nitrogen fixation. And his laboratory was known as the Frisch Laboratory because that foundation had equipped it. But by the time I got here, those funds were just about used up, and he got a grant from the Rockefeller Foundation. Hmm. And so I know that, for example, the money that I had as research assistant came from Rockefeller Foundation.
Except for your first year was with Wharf.
Yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You took other courses, of course. You said you didn't, and we had an earlier talk about this interview, you didn't take a course with Baldwin, but you did have one with E.B. Fred.
Yes, I had one with E.B. Fred. I took a course in soil bacteriology with E.B. Fred. My training before I came as an undergraduate, and the department at Austin was slanted really towards medical bacteriology at that time. And except for the work that Dr. Lewis was doing in cytology, but the courses that were given were slanted towards medical bacteriology because that's about what people knew the most about. There were only a few places dealing in things bacterial physiology, cytology, and things like that.
So you came here and you had to learn some things about...
I had to learn some things about agricultural bacteria, such as soil bacteriology. Mm. I took Dr. Fred's course at that time.
How was he as a teacher? How did you find him?
Dr. Fred was a very thorough teacher. He was not a particularly... good lecturer, just like I guess most people would say he wasn't a very good speech maker. But he gave good lectures. He was fairly demanding in what he required of people. Very thorough, very well organized course. I found him I wouldn't say as stimulating as Dr. Lewis had been at the University of Texas, but certainly he was a very thorough and good teacher and knew the subject well, had it well organized, and knew. Furthermore, he had a wide range of acquaintance and certainly knew the people that were doing contemporary work. And so he could talk about what others were doing right now in their research in soil microbiology. So in that respect, he was very good.
Yeah. Have courses with? Could you talk about something?
Yes, I had a course in dairy bacteriology with Professor Hastings, and that was a very thorough course and a very good course. Things that I really had no knowledge of at all. I learned a lot about dairy bacteriology. I also took a course in food bacteriology with Dr. Frazier, William Frazier, which again was an excellent course. Now, while I did not take a course with Dr. Baldwin, His course in bacterial physiology was one that brought a number of students here to Wisconsin, because it was the only one given in the country at that time, in the late 1930s. I took it in the spring of 1940, but by that time Dr. Baldwin had had, I guess it was called then, a nervous breakdown, and was away from the university. And it was taught by Wayne Umbright, who was an instructor in the department, who had taken a PhD here a couple of years before. And it was an excellent course. And I found Wayne a very, very stimulating teacher.
He wasn't in biochemistry.
No. Wayne Umbright was in bacteriology.
Mm-hmm.
Wayne left here and went to Cornell, and from Cornell he went to Rutgers and was for many years chairman of the Department of Bacteriology at Rutgers. He just retired recently. Yeah.
He became interested in the founding of the Enzyme Institute, I know. He wrote a letter with some suggestions about that.
Sure. Yes. Yeah.
You knew Marvin Johnson.
I knew Marv Johnson. Yes, I took courses from him. I knew him as a friend, and also I knew him as a teacher. He was a very stimulating teacher. I don't know whether you have seen the university memorial document that was written about Marv Johnson, but that certainly caught the spirit of Marv Johnson.
A great many people have talked about him. I'd be curious as to what you would say yourself.
Oh, Marv was a good teacher. He was an exciting teacher. He was an exacting person. Many people were, many students were more or less, I wouldn't say they were afraid of him, but they didn't ask to have him on oral examinations and things like that. And Marv could be in a seminar, particularly there was a seminar held in biochemistry those days called Fermentation Journal Club that was held by, it was Dr. W.H. Peterson's journal club, but Dr. Peterson and Marv Johnson ran it. And Marv had, he had the reputation of being a pretty hard-nosed questioner of the graduate student giving the seminar.
Mm-hmm.
And he could really cut you down if he felt that you were trying to gloss over something that you really didn't have a good background on.
Mm-hmm.
Or trying to present something that you didn't have a good enough background on. But I would say Marv went out of his way to help people, went out of his way to explain things that were very difficult to understand. He had a knack of simplifying them. And if you could put up with some of his blunt mannerisms and weren't afraid of some of his rather blunt considerations of what you may or may not know, he was a good friend.
You mean could you give an example of, when you say blunt mannerisms, he wouldn't bother with the politenesses and this could be a little better, that sort of thing?
No, he wouldn't bother with those kind of, that kind of polite talk. He would say, well, why don't you do it this way, or why in the world do you bother with presenting this? There are lots better ways to talk about it, and you ought to know it, type of thing. And if you were talking about any compound, and he would say, well, let's just look at it and see what it looks like. And if you couldn't write the structural formula of it, then you didn't know really what you were talking about.
And what did he do then?
Well, he would just correct you, whether it was in front of the journal club people or whether it was in a private conversation. I mean, he didn't seem to make much difference with Marv whether he was talking to you as an individual like we're sitting at mm-hmm. this desk, or whether you were trying to give a seminar to 15 or 20 people. He would talk with you in the same blunt manner. He wouldn't, he didn't pull his punches, in other words, whether it was with you as an individual or whether it was in front of a group of people. But he also expected that of anyone in talking with him, too. So So he wasn't doing anything that he didn't expect other people to react in the same way to him.
But it wasn't a question of actually making people miserable, or...
No, and I don't think Marv ever intended to make anybody miserable, but it was just his persistence and his desire that things be done right.
I would gather he was the sort of person that if you were a good scientist, that he would be tremendously exciting. That's what
exactly
people have said, that that he was willing to share ideas with people that he had.
And I think, as Bob Burris put it too, was he was willing to share ideas, all of his ideas, and he wanted to go on to new things. And if somebody else was exploiting these ideas, he didn't want to continue to do that. He wanted to go on and do something else. And he always had things exciting going on in his laboratory.
Did you feel, as some people have, that he was perhaps exploited by Fred and Peterson, I guess, or in the sense that he didn't himself shine in, or put his name first in?
No, you would have to know Marv to understand that. At least my idea would be that you would have to know Marv to understand that I don't think this was true. That's my opinion anyway. That Marv needed someone to take care of the bureaucracy of the university for him, because that was something he didn't want to bother with. And I think Marv, in the position he had, where Dr. Fred and Dr. Peterson were sort of the front for a lot of the things, was the kind of thing that helped Marv. Mm-hmm. That would be my opinion.
Mm-hmm.
I know this has been said before, what you've just said, but I've never felt it that way, that Marv enjoyed being left alone in the laboratory to do what he wanted to do in his own way, mm-hmm. with his own students or with other students. And he didn't want to bother with a lot of the petty bureaucracies that people have to put up with, that other people do put up with.
Mm-hmm. Is there anybody else you'd mention in bacteriology at that time?
Well, Perry Wilson was there, but I knew him primarily, of course, I was his graduate student, and through working with him. Perry was also known as much like Marv, was known as a hardworking person who expected other people to work hard too. And Perry was very generous with his time and very generous with his ideas in working with other people as well as graduate students. You know, no question about whose ideas there were when the work was finally done. It was the several people who had done it that, even though Perry may have taken a lot of the data after it had been worked up, and Perry may have taken talked to people and written a paper, all the names were on the paper and everybody had a chance to go over it before it was sent off for publication.
It's important, isn't it?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Did you have any courses in biochemistry?
Yes, I took a course in biochemistry with W.H. Peterson, Carl Paul Link, Conrad Elvium, E.B. Hart.
Mm-hmm.
Carl Paul Link, of course, was a very exciting lecturer, and I think Dr. Link was a good teacher, he was a good teacher. He presented material that he had on carbohydrates. He taught the course in carbohydrate chemistry. He presented that, a lot of structural formulas that I guess in that day were probably a little more important than they are now, but he demanded that everybody memorize them, and we did. W.H. Peterson taught a course in fermentation chemistry, along with Marv Johnson, and W.H. Peterson taught it together when I took it. And again, I thought that was a very good course. Marv Johnson was by far the better lecturer of the two. Dr. Peterson was sort of a droning type of lecturer, but he had a lot of information to present, and it was a good course. E.B. Hart, by the time I took Dr. Hart's course in nutrition, I believe it was, I think that was it, or animal nutrition, I believe it was. He had been teaching it for so long, I guess, it had gotten, he wasn't as enthusiastic about it, I guess, as he had been in the past. Yeah, but he was getting up towards his retirement. Dr. Elvium taught a course in enzymes. Again, Elvium and Marv Johnson taught the course at that time together. And again, Dr. Elvium, as you may have known, like Dr. Fred, was not what you would call a stimulating lecturer, but he certainly knew the material, and it was a good course. Marv Johnson was the one that gave the stimulating lectures in that course. I took a course in colloid chemistry from Jack Williams in the Department of Chemistry, and it was to me a new and different area of work, and I enjoyed it very much. But my problem in that course was that it was a graduate course for chemists, and the mathematics were a little beyond me. But I enjoyed the course very much. I got a lot out of it. I can't at the moment think of. Oh, I took a course in the Department of Philosophy in humanism.
Well, that's
from Carl Begholt.
Did you?
Yes. Max Otto was still here then, and I thought that I was going to be taking a course from Max Otto, but Professor Begholt taught it at that time.
What made you decide to take a course in philosophy?
Oh, I just wanted to. I had done a lot of reading, and after all, Max Otto was well known for his ideas on humanism. And I believe the book that I remember reading was Things and Ideals. I'd forgotten, hadn't thought about that in years, but I don't know whether you knew Max Otto or his work. Have you not?
I know about him.
Oh, yeah. And among the books that he had written a lot of, and I read Things and Ideals and a book on humanism, and I enjoyed it. And he was listed as being a professor up there and offering a course. So I went up and took it, and it was Carl Begholt who was teaching it. So
How was it with Carl Begholt? Did you learn from him?
Oh, yes. I enjoyed it very much. Yes, I enjoyed his course.
Was this because, being a scientist, you thought you ought to learn something about humanism, or you wanted to, or?
I wanted to. Yes, I wanted to. I don't remember thinking I ought to know something. Mm. I just wanted to. I regret that I did not have the time to take some courses in the Department of History, or I would have liked to have taken courses in English literature, but I. Well, and I know the English literature stems from a high school teacher I had. I was fortunate enough to have her for my whole 4 years in high school, and she loved English literature, and I got a dose of it for 4 years, and got a love of it myself.
So you were doing some reading of that sort. Did you go on while you were a graduate student, or were you too busy?
I was too busy, really. Yeah. I was too busy. It was just so many other things, you know. While you're an undergraduate, you think you're busy, and when then you get to be a graduate, and you think, my God, if I ever catch up, I'm going to... And when I finally get through, I'll catch up and have a chance to do other things, and you just keep getting busier and busier. So.
Did many? I haven't found anybody who's spoken of taking courses other than science courses. Did any of your friends, your graduate student friends, do that?
I don't think so. I can't remember any of them doing it. No, I can't remember any of them doing it. I know when Orville Weiss was a graduate student in that same laboratory with Bob Burris and I, with Perry Wilson, Orville went on and became the chairman at Austin and was chairman of microbiology at Austin for many years until he just retired recently. But Orville and I went up and took a course that one year Lancelot Hogben was here from England as a visiting scholar, and he gave a series, he gave a course in the history of science.
Uh-huh.
And Orv and I took that course together.
What did you say his name was?
Lancelot Hogben, H-O-D-G-B-E-N. I believe that was this. He had, at that time, he had a number of publications on the history of, and he'd think, yeah, I'm sure he wrote one on the history of mathematics. Yeah.
Were you, this was 1939, wasn't it?
Yeah, 39, 40, yeah.
How aware were you of the war and the, what was going on in Europe?
Well, I was certainly, I was well aware of the war. I came here, of course, I came here in the September of 39, and of course that's when the when the invasion of Poland went on. I had known, when I was at Austin in the university, there were a several German and Czech communities in Central Texas, and certainly those people were well aware of the German invasion of Czechoslovakia, or takeover of Czechoslovakia. And they certainly had discussions of that, in which people that I knew there as friends at Austin. Mm-hmm. So I was aware of that. Also, a friend of mine there who was in bacteriology, his father was a Lutheran minister in a small town in Central Texas where German was still spoken, and he his church services were conducted in German. Now this was, see, this was in the middle 1930s. And and I remember visiting in their home in the summer of 1939 when the discussion was going on then about the possible, what was happening in Germany and the possibility of war. And of course, after I came here, keeping up with it in the newspapers on a daily basis. So you're aware of it.
So it was always there?
It was always there, mm-hmm. always there, yes. But not the fact that we would become involved.
I see.
Yeah. Not the fact that we would become involved. It was, I guess, the furthest thing from the mind of most of us then.
I don't normally ask very much about military careers, but Bob Burris said that you were at Dietrich,
exactly,
Maryland,
yes.
and that seems to have, what, a chemical, what were you doing?
That was the biological warfare station.
I see,
there
yes.
were a lot of people there. I suspect that you won't find a bacteriologist my age in the country who wasn't there. Yes, I went into the Army and I was commissioned as a first lieutenant in the sanitary corps of the medical department. And that was they were the people who did the laboratory work and all sorts of things like that for hospitals. I went to New Orleans and was at the New Orleans port of embarkation for a year.
Yeah.
I was in New Orleans for a year, and then at that time the effort in finding out the what the potential in biological warfare of what we could do if the idea was that the Germans were working on it, and I guess that there was some evidence that the Japanese were, and what should we do to defend ourselves if that was being done. So I was ordered to Camp Dietrich in the summer of 1943. And I spent the rest of my war years there. I was the executive officer and deputy chief of the safety division.
What's the safety division?
Well, laboratory safety is a well-established thing now, and we have a lot of it around the university.
I see what you mean, then. It was the and protection of the people.
Protection of the people and the surrounding community.
Uh-huh. All right.
Yeah. And so I spent my 4 years there, and with a lot of other people who are up towards retirement age. By now.
Was that important to you in terms of your career at all?
It was very important to me in terms of my career, because I got back into after doing graduate work here in microbial chemistry and microbial physiology, really, I got back into medical microbiology and
because
medical bacteria because of that, yes. Hmm. And I worked there with Dr. Gail Dack, the University of Chicago, who was chief of the safety division. Walter Nungester, University of Michigan, who chairman of the department at Michigan for many years, was there. He was a medical microbiologist, and a lot of other people, too. Mm-hmm. And then, towards the end of World War II, or after World War II was over, and everybody was looking for where they could go, I still had not finished my PhD. At least I had finished everything but taking the exam. Mm-hmm. So the people here were needing somebody in the Department of Bacteriology who had an interest in infectious agents, because Bang's disease in dairy cattle had become a very important aspect of the dairying industry here in Wisconsin during the 1930s and into the 1940s. And so the state legislature in the middle 1940s gave a good amount of money to the university and the College of Agriculture to do some work on controlling Bang's disease in the dairy cattle population. And so the people in bacteriology and in veterinary science were trying to get people to do that research. And I came back then as an instructor in bacteriology to establish a research program on the Bang's disease organisms in the Department of Bacteriology. Now, I should point out that this would not be new to that department, because work was done during a little work on Bang's disease was done in the 1920s and 1930s here in the Department of Veterinary Science and the Department of Bacteriology, but they had a long tradition of working with infectious diseases of animals. The first work on tuberculosis, for example, in Wisconsin was done by Russell, Dean Russell, after he came here in the late 1800s and showed that and used the tuberculin test on the dairy cattle, the dairy herd of the university and so on. So there's a long tradition of working with infectious diseases, of joint work between the veterinarians and the Department of Bacteriology. And so I came here and we set up a laboratory, or at least started work on Brucella.
Was this much of a departure from your... You had been working in nitrogen fixation.
I've been working in nitrogen fixation, yes.
Mm-hmm. So how different was it for you to move into this?
It wasn't very different at all, because it was simply changing organisms and doing some of the same things with these organisms that I had been doing with the nitrogen-fixing organisms. I had worked on nutrition of some of the nitrogen-fixing bacteria, and we wanted to find out about the nutrition of Brucella to try to be able to grow them better in the laboratory. Mm-hmm. We had to work on identification of the Brucella organisms in only in this sense, however. The identification had been worked out long before, how to go about isolating and identifying in the lab. Mm-hmm. The particular problem given me, however, was to see if we could find a way of identifying Brucella abortus strain 19, because this particular organism had been developed by the Department of U.S. Department of Agriculture and was being used as a living organism vaccine to put into dairy calves. Mm-hmm. And the question was, can it be spread from those animals, from the dairy calves to people, or if it infected the cows, could it spread from the cows to people? Well, the real question was, how do we know it's strain 19 or not some other field strain of Brucella abortus? So we had to find a way to specifically identify strain 19.
Who assigned you this problem?
All right. That problem was assigned to me by Dr. Frazier, who was chairman of the Department of Bacteriology at that time. He's the one that hired me uh-huh. as an instructor and said, well, he didn't give me that particular problem. He just said, come back here and we need somebody to work on Brucella. Mm-hmm. And nobody ever said you're to work on this or you're to uh-huh. work on that, but in talking with the people in veterinary science who were doing work on vaccination and had some herds of cattle, they were doing testing of several vaccine strains at that time, along with the Department of Agriculture. Mm-hmm. It seemed to me in talking with them, the question was, well, if strain 19 is the approved strain for vaccination and we're working on it, we better have a way of identifying that strain. Yeah. So that if the veterinarians who are infecting the cattle, if they got infected with Brucella, was that strain 19, or did that present a real hazard? Mm. And did it present a hazard to people? So we worked on...
And who's the we? That was the rest of my question. That worked on it.
All right. My graduate students.
You already had some.
Yes, because... I came back here. I was only an instructor, but you remember this was in 1946, and we had that whole backlog of students, people who were in World War II wanting to come back to school. And we had many more, the graduate student population just, you might say, erupted. And so we had a number of graduate students who just came here to do graduate work, and if they were accepted, fine. So I had graduate students, although my memory is that I guess the first year I was here, maybe Dr. Frazier really had to be their professor, because as an instructor I couldn't be, but
yeah.
But nevertheless, they worked me in. Mm-hmm. So. So we looked at all kinds of problems on Brucella, but to answer your question, it wasn't. The laboratory approach wasn't a whole lot different than what we had been doing on the nitrogen-fixing organisms. We've been working on the physiology of them to try to understand the organisms. We've been working on the nutrition to try to understand them. And so we just... changed organisms from, or at least I just changed organisms from rhizobia to to Brusella. And I and the graduate students working with me came back to that problem many times on how to identify strain 19. We worked out a method, or at least we, yes, I guess you'd say we worked out a method. Hilly Levine, who's in the School of Public Health at the University of California at Berkeley and has been there many years, was one of my first graduate students working on that. And we found a method for identifying strain 19. And then over the years, other students came back to it because we began comparing strains of different degrees of virulence to find out why some strains of Brucella produced a severe disease and some strains produced no disease much at all. And it's the kind of problem that others have, not with Brucella but with many other organisms, have worked on. They're continuing to do research in this area, trying to understand what separates the different strains of bacteria of the same species, some producing severe infections, some producing mild infections.
Sounds as if it gets into genetics.
It does get into genetics, but mind you, this was in the 1940s, and we didn't know much about microbial genetics. As a matter of fact, in Brucella abortus, one of the requirements for growth of it was an increased partial pressure of carbon dioxide in the container where we incubated the organism in small little vessels, and we had tubes of the organism, test tubes of the organism, but we would put baskets of these test tubes like in a desiccator or some covered container, and we would have to add 10% carbon dioxide to the air to get 5 to 10% to get good growth of the organism. So what could we substitute for the carbon dioxide? And one of the students I had working with me at the time put onto that problem, and we used C14, a radioactive carbon. And keep in mind, this was in the late 1940s, so we didn't know much about it. And that student went on then, and by that time Josh Lederberg had come here, and that student took a course in genetics from Josh Lederberg, and with that we worked out that there was a genetic problem, and we worked out the rate of mutation, because everybody knew that you could train Brucella abortus to grow in air. You had to transfer them quite a number of times. It kept reducing the carbon dioxide, and we know now we were simply selecting a mutant that was capable of growth in air. And Jerry Marr, who's now dean of the graduate school at Davis, did the work on that problem. We were first working on how carbon dioxide of the air was incorporated into the chemicals inside the bacterial cell. And then we became interested in this problem of training, and Jerry worked out the mutation rate at that time to show that it was simply a mutant.
That was a surprise. It was sort of a...
It was a surprise because, see, up to that time, up until World War II, people talked about training bacteria to do this, and you could train bacteria to do this and train back. They weren't thinking of it in the sense of the psychology aspect, but they knew that if you did certain cookbook things, that you could change the organism from this to this. And
Adapting in effect.
Adaptation is the word that was used. Sure, mm-hmm. Adapting it. Adapting it to grow in the air.
Mm-hmm.
And Jerry worked out that it was a mutation.
Did and he on his own, or was this...
He was working with me. He was a graduate student.
Yeah.
He was working with me, and he talked a lot with Josh about this, and...
somebody must have just suddenly surmised that that's what it was.
Sure.
Was it Lettifer, do you think?
Oh, I don't think so. I think that Jerry and I did it, because, after all, we'd been reading the other things, too, you know,
yeah.
What was going on, and about the ideas of... Josh and so on, well, we applied it to our own organism. And here, this training was nothing more than selection of a mutant. Let's see, let's do some of these tests that the geneticists were doing on mutation rates and see if it applied. And sure enough, it did. And that the mutation rate that we got for this organism to be able to grow in the air was in the range that was acceptable as mutation rates for other bacteria, like Escherichia coli, that were being worked on by a lot of people. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. Were you the only one working on Brucella?
No, Dave Berman. I'm sorry.
Well, I meant in the country.
Oh, no.
A lot of people.
There were a lot of people working on it. Werner Brown, who was at Berkeley, California, was doing a lot of work. He was a German. He was a refugee. His family were refugees from Germany. And Werner was at Berkeley and published some very early papers on adaptation of Brucella. Mm-hmm. And from our work on mutation, we got with Werner, and so we had a working arrangement with Werner Brown for a number of years on working with Brucella. A man named Huddleston at Michigan State had done Brucella work. There was a large group but there were several people at the Department of Agriculture laboratories in Washington.
Mm-hmm.
One of my old teachers at Austin, Vernon Shuhart, had worked on Brucella he was starting to work on it when I came here in 1939 because of the problem of Brucella causing abortion in dairy cattle and problems in milk.
Mm-hmm.
And so to answer your question, there were a lot of people. Sandy Elberg, who was one of our compatriots at Dietrich during World War II, was from Berkeley, went back to Berkeley, and continued his work on Brucella there in the Department of Bacteriology and then in the School of Public Health. Well, Sandy's just retired from there as dean of the graduate school at Berkeley, and so it was people like that that I...
What was your, among the many kinds of research you did on Brucella, what was your most important contribution?
Well, I guess our most important contribution from the standpoint of Brucella work per se was the set of laboratory tests we finally put together over about 15 years to identify strain 19.
Yeah.
And the interesting thing is we came back to it in the middle to late 1960s in this way. We first started on it in the middle 1940s with the idea of we've got to know about identification of this organism because of all the Brucella isolated. We've got to know if any of them are strain 19, that's getting into the dairy cattle population through vaccination.
Okay.
Well, as the dairy cattle population became vaccinated and through the so-called test and slaughter program, and I don't know whether you're familiar with that, of which there are tests for identification of infected animals, and then there is a government subsidy to the dairy farmer for the slaughter of the infected animals.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
And so weeding them out of the herd. We finally got down, we did get down as one of the first states, not the first, but among the first states to be accredited by the USDA as brucellosis free. all right, we're still vaccinating with strain 19. An occasional adult cow would appear in a herd that had an abortion, and a brucella could be isolated. Was that strain 19 that it, you know, that had infected? Understand, this is a living vaccine.
Yeah.
The calves are infected with it for vaccination at a very early age, up to 4 or 5 months of age, and they become immune.
Yes.
But in a rare instance, they do not get rid of the organism, but the organism stays with them. And then when they become adults, they may show an abortion. Well, and there were people who had become infected because of this.
Mm-hmm.
So again, we came back, well, is this strain 19? Well, fortunately, we'd continued to sort of piddle with that problem over the years, and now then we had a series of tests that we could do, and it was important to show that, or the question really became, well, if you have a successful program, vaccination program, and you finally get rid of the disease, when do you quit vaccinating?
Yeah.
And so, and can you prove that the organism that's present in the dairy cattle population is only strain 19 and not some other organism? So that's how we came back to it.
When you found the answer?
We found indeed that the state laboratory of hygiene over here were asking us that question. We had worked with them over the years on some of these problems of how to culture, how to cultivate the organism, and best ways to cultivate it, best ways to identify it, and all this kind of thing. And then they would occasionally get there'd be a case of human brucellosis, usually in a dairy farmer. Well, was this strain 19 that he got from his vaccinated animals? And we found that a number of these strains, I haven't thought about this problem in some years now, but a number of these strains in the late 60s and early 70s indeed were strain 19. So you would have to ask the question, when do we quit vaccinating?
Yeah.
Well, I guess they're still asking that question. But you know, this is the same thing, in human infections or human diseases where you do have vaccination programs. When do you quit vaccinating?
Yeah. Yes, I haven't thought of that.
We've answered it. In, for example, smallpox. Smallpox is not smallpox is not an accepted pediatric. Smallpox vaccination has not been an accepted pediatric procedure now for the last number of years, because there's more danger in immunizing the infants than there is that they would ever get smallpox, because of the eradication of smallpox on a worldwide basis. And indeed, so why subject children to smallpox vaccination if they're never going to come in contact with smallpox? So you've got the same thing in animal diseases too. When do you quit vaccinating? We don't vaccinate in this country much anymore against typhoid fever, where one time it was the idea of vaccinate everybody against typhoid.
Was your research in staphylococcus and streptococcus, was that related to this, or was that something else?
Well, it was related to problems brought to us by, or at least that I, in talking with the people in Vet Science again, that it was related to, I guess, why I came back here after World War II, was to be a person in bacteriology who would be who would work with the people in veterinary science on particular problems that I felt that I had the background to work on, we had the background to work on, to help them and to help try to answer some questions that we were trying to solve. the one on Staphylococcus came about very simply. Streptococci in general are highly susceptible to penicillin. Up until the late 1940s, most of the mammary gland infection or mastitis in dairy cattle was caused by streptococci. But starting in, well, not too long after World War II, when penicillin became available, it was used in treating dairy cattle to cure streptococcal mastitis. Mm-hmm. But when you cure one disease, you quite frequently see another one that you had been masked because there was a more acute problem.
Yes.
Well, when Streptococcus mastitis, the incidence of Streptococcus mastitis among dairy cattle began to go down, the veterinarians and the people here in vet science who were following the problem began to see an increase in Staphylococcus mastitis. Well, was the Staphylococcus mastitis actually an increase in amount of disease, or was the fact that it was more easily recognized now that they'd gotten rid of Streptococcus mastitis? Mm-hmm. So then the question that we started asking, well, where are these staphylococci coming from? In the, oh, I guess up until the 1940s, the better part of wisdom was that the natural habitat or the reservoir of infection of staphylococci was in the human nasal passages. Some 50% of all human beings carry staphylococci in their nasal passages. So were the cows getting the staphylococci from the dairy farmer, or was it being passed from cow to cow? Was it a cow staphylococcus? And they weren't, were, well, how do you go, it's the Brucella question all over again. How do you identify? So we became interested in a number of problems of how to tell bovine staphylococci, if there were such things, from human staphylococci, if there were just humans, or was it all the same staphylococcus? Mm-hmm. Well, we developed over a number of years a battery of tests to really identify staphylococci that came from cows, and then we began to ask the question, well, are there dog staphylococci, are there deer staphylococci, are there wild animal staphylococci, or maybe the cattle were becoming infected from animals around them.
I gather you found the word, is that right?
Well, what we found was not quite as clear cut as that. We found that there were some staphylococci that we could identify as human staphylococci by our test anyway, but we did recover them from dairy cattle. But we did find that there were a number of staphylococci by the test that we used that were never recovered from human infections or from human nasal passages. That were present in the dairy cattle population, so we call those bovine staphylococci. Well, it's a question that I don't know that there's no clear-cut answer, but there was sort of a gradation. I had a graduate student, a young woman, took a master's degree and later went to medical school. She was an anesthesiologist up in Duluth. Kay Russell worked on the problem of nasal carriage of human staphylococci, and we used in people, and she did nasal swabbings on a large number of people around the campus, some that we followed for a couple of years, and we found that, and we had methods of identifying strains of human staphylococci as well as strains of bovine staphylococci and so on. We found that there are some people, we could always get the same strain of staphylococci by our test. We could always get the same strain every time we did a nasal swab. We found that there were some people from whom we never recovered staphylococci. And that, of course, always raised the question. We never really got around to trying to do any, but that's another research question. Why do some people carry staphylococci and other people don't? What's the difference between them?
Yeah.
Well, anyway, it's...
You must have been working with medical people.
Yes, sure.
When you got to that kind of research.
Well, I was. It always has been. I worked with the people over in the State Lab of Hygiene on the Brucella question. Vic Seastone was chairman over here, and talking about staphylococci and streptococci, I, you know, worked with him.
Was there anybody in the department doing research at all similar?
Elizabeth McCoy she and I did some collaborative staphylococcal work. Yes. Elizabeth McCoy worked on a lot of different things. She was interested in so many different things. She was interested in some diseases. Now, the reason she and I worked together on staphylococci is she ran a dairy farm just south of Madison.
That's right, yes.
Yeah. She had this dairy farm, and they had mastitis problems.
Mm-hmm.
And she was as well informed about the mastitis problem as the practicing veterinarians and as the research people down here.
I think I will.